So good morning to all of you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So very, I'm honored by Lions Club and Mr. RK for inviting me to speak here and give you an opportunity to address such an erudite audience. On top of that, Manager Narayanan, while introducing me, has praised me to the level that I'm going to talk about Ellis. Ellis deserves some of those encomiums. I did not, a couple of minor clarifications, I did not sacrifice any career to do service to history or anything. I do these things because they interest me and I'm, incited by the passion of people like Ellis and his precursors and other people. Actually, several people here are here who are far more accomplished than me or done far more. Hopefully, they'll also get to speak in the future. They have actually spoken at several fora. Major Narayan also took away some of my thunder because I knew that most people would not know who Ellis was or assume it is Ellis Duncan. So, in this RK Hall, we have a lot of Carnatic Kacheris. So, you have the famous people, Carnatic field famously, you have people named after their towns, identified by their towns more than by their personalities. So, you have Aryakudi and Semangudi and Mussoorie and even M.S. Subbalakshmi is Madurai. MS, that M stands for Madurai, and so you have a lot of people, this thing. One of those, all they will be named after some village or the other from wherever they were born or brought up. With one exception, which is Patnam Subramanyaya, who is named after Madras Patnam, because he lived here for a very long period. So, a lot of the people who were born, brought up here also will take names from some other ancestral village. So, just to identify themselves, otherwise there will be 30 people, 40 people named after Madras. But here, look at this. I'm going to talk about an Englishman. His name is Francis White Ellis. But he refers to himself, and you'll see that a little poem that comes in later, as Chennai Pattanathu Ellison. He was born and brought up in England. He came to India to work for the East India Company. He came as a writer. And he served India with great love. He was mostly working in the Madras Presidency. And he saved the fact that he is unknown, and the fact that he was actually somewhat unknown even to scholars until recently, is a sad statement of historical affairs. So we'll address this. Most of you have lived in Madras. You've gone to the beach. There have been for about last 30-40 years. There are about 12 statues of people who have contributed greatly to Tamil literature, Tamil history, and so on. Some of them are real, some of them are mythical. For example, Kannagi, it's a debate whether she is real or not. Others, we don't know what they look like. There's a picture of Thiruvalluvar, Avvaiyar, Kamban, etc., Ilangovadigal. We have no pictures of them, only, artists rendering. Whereas others you had. So, Avvaiyar and Thiruvalluvar, of course, obviously, very famous historical figures, not forgotten, well-beloved in Tamil history. Some more modern people are like Kamaraj, Bharati, Bharatidasan, their statues are also there. Among this plethora of people who have served Tamil, there are two strange Englishmen also who are honored like this. One is G.U. Pope and the other is Father Robert Caldwell. Pope is fondly called Pope Ayyar in Tamil. And Pope is famous for, he's not actually a Pope, his name is Pope, he's nothing to do with the Vatican. Because I have had people ask this to me in confusion, so I want to clarify that. His name is simply Pope. There is even an Alexander Pope earlier, also nothing to do with the Vatican of Newton's time. So Pope's major contribution is a translation of Thirukkural and a translation of the Thiruvasagam, Manikavasagar's Thiruvasagam. These are very famous, these are like... when it comes to English translations of Tamil texts, they stand out, like a lighthouse. They are very, very important. Caldwell is perhaps less known to the general public, but better known to the grammarians and scholars and linguists and so on. Caldwell is reputed to have discovered the Dravidian group of languages. He actually wrote a book in 1856 called The Comparative Grammar of the Dravidian Languages. And in public memory, Caldwell is honored thus. Dravida Moligalin Oppilakkanam Vagitha Angileya. You can see that first line, Robert Caldwell. And that's what the stone honoring him says, the statue in the marina. So these are two famous books that they are famous, the chief contributions, Pope's Thirukkural. And you can see that cover page of the comparative grammar of the Dravidian or South Indian family of languages. And this was published in 1856. You know, the word Dravidian signifies something else today. It stands for a particular kind of party ideology. It stands for ethnic separation. We have this Aryan invasion theory and theory that Dravidians are the original inhabitants of India and Aryans were some people who came from the northwest somewhere in the Caucasus Mountains and came to invade India. But that is not the name or context in which Caldwell wrote his book. Dravidian there, the Dravidian family of languages simply refers to a language group, not to an ethnic group or a race or even a nation of people. And so this is famous, and this book came out in 1856. And so in the last 150 years, if you ask anybody, most people would say that the Dravidian languages identified as a separate group was done by the scholarly work of Robert Caldwell. What is not known about Caldwell generally is that he actually discovered a third group of languages. These are called the Munda group of languages. These are spoken mainly by tribals in central India. This is different from either the Dravidian group of languages or the Aryan group of languages, which we expect, you know, which we think are derived from Sanskrit, and we have some connection to Greek and Rome, Latin. So he actually discovered the third group, but that is generally not known about him. And he's falsely been attributed the discovery of the Dravidian group of languages. He did not discover it. The person I am going to refer to, the subject of our talk today, Francis Vitalis, was the actual person who discovered the Dravidian group of languages, and he did it 40 years before, in 1816. And we'll talk about that. That is not his only contribution. That's not why I'm talking about Ellis today. Ellis did a lot of things, and that's why I'm going to talk about him today. But before we talk about Ellis, we have to start with another gentleman, a truly profound, brilliant scholar, one of the most amazing personalities, you can say personalities in England, scholars, just say one of the greatest scholars, one of the greatest Englishmen, one of the greatest Orientalists, any epithet will fit him. He is unfortunately not very well known today. Today, we, thanks to the independence movement, the English are probably much more vilified than they ought to be. They did a lot of contributions to Indian society, and we tend to look at the negatives and not look at the positives. So William Jones is actually one of the great geniuses of all time. What he is famous for, he had already famous in England for a lot of things. He studied to be a lawyer, but could not, he actually wrote a book on law, but could not find employment as a lawyer there. He was invited by Warren Hastings, who was the Governor General in Calcutta after Robert Clive. Warren Hastings invited William Jones to be what's called a puisne judge. That means not the Chief Justice, but one of the other judges in what is called the Supreme Court of Calcutta or Supreme Court of Bengal, established, actually it's called Supreme Court of Calcutta, established in Bengal when the East India Company took over the Bengal province. And so he came as a judge, but he was also a scholar of great repute. Actually, I could talk 2 hours about Jones, and it would, you know, not one dull moment will be there. That's the number of accomplishments he has done. But this is only about, introduce him to talk about how he seeded Ellis, who came about 30 years later. William Jones founded the Asiatic Society of Bengal, because when the British first came to India, they came only as traders. They did not come with ambitions to rule. And they came to the first fort really where they captured power is Madras, the Fort St. George, which happened in 1639. But that fort was really for business. They had somebody called a factor. He was really just a chief businessman, a chief trader. So they were really doing business for 100 years or so, until Clive came along and started conquering a lot of those territories. Then Clive conquered Bengal, the famous Battle of Plassey that we all know about. Now the British found themselves with not, you know, just districts or small towns in their hands, but literally two very large provinces, you know, which are effectively nations at one time. They suddenly, you heard the phrase, the British accidentally acquired an empire in India. It's probably somewhat true. Now they had to administer the country. And how do they administer a country that they knew very little about? There is very little information that they could gather. William Jones came to India as a scholar in Greek, Latin, Persian, Gothic. I'll tell one little incident about him. You have heard of the famous Nadir Shah, the Persian king who invaded Delhi and sacked it. Nadir Shah went back to Persia and wrote an autobiography in the Persian language. So that was well before, about 50-60 years before Jones's time. But King Christian of Denmark, note this, King Christian of Denmark wanted a translation of Nadir Shah's autobiography, which was written in Persian. And he wanted a translation not into Danish, but in French, because French was one of the big scholarly languages of that time. And to do this, he approached William Jones, an Englishman. A Danish king approaches an Englishman to translate a Persian's autobiography into the French language. You think about what an absurd situation this would be today. But he did it because of Jones had acquired such a great reputation as a linguist and a scholar, which he did. Then when Jones came to Calcutta, he established, besides being a member of the Supreme Court of Calcutta, he started in his spare time an organization called the Asiatic Society of Bengal to study Indian history, to study Indian arts, to write a history of India, to understand the Sanskrit language and all its literature, to understand the Persian language and all its literature. His ambition was just amazing, astounding. While he was studying this, he actually had some difficulty learning Sanskrit because nobody would teach him. But some Vaishya acquaintance actually agreed to, Radha Kumar, I think his name was, he agreed to teach him. Then because no Brahmin would teach him that. And when they were judging and sitting in judgment of Indians, they needed to judge Indians by their laws. They could not judge them by Christian laws. So they wanted a translation of the Manusmriti, which was only available in Sanskrit. And they had to rely on Brahmin pandits who would interpret it. And they had to judge Muslims by the Sharia, which would be only interpreted by Arabic mullahs. Now, some of the mullahs and some of the Brahmin pandits who did these translations in court were very corrupt. And they could, this Englishman could see corruption. You do not teach corruption to an Englishman, but he could recognize it when he saw it. And as a judge, he saw a lot of this. And he said, this is not going to work. We cannot render judgment. These guys are, interpreting differently and conveniently based on whether they are getting, and this is something that is happening in our judicial system even now. Though technically, if you speak about it, you'll be held in contempt of court. So he wanted to study these languages. He already knew Persian and he learned Arabic on the ship while coming from London to India. Think about this. He was a master scholar. He had actually translated Hamlet into Latin at the age of 12, I think. So that is the level of the scholarship. So Jones came to India with tremendous reputation. So one of the projects that he wanted to do was translate the Manusmriti and the Sharia. While he was studying Sanskrit, he realized that the teacher that was teaching him was surprised because he picked it up very, very fast. In 6 months, he became very proficient in Sanskrit. And the reason he was able to do it is because he had an affinity, he felt a very clear affinity to the grammatical structure of Sanskrit with Latin and Greek, which was part of the classical education in England at that time. Latin and Greek were the scholarly languages taught to any scholar in England. If you became a lawyer in England, you would learn Latin or Greek or both. Winston Churchill was the first person who complained about it, saying instead of teaching us useful English, they are teaching us all this nonsensical Latin and Greek. I don't understand what half the stuff they are talking about is in the English grammar. So that was Winston Churchill's complaint 100 years later. But this fellow was already a scholar. And he said there must be some resemblance, resemblance among the grammatical structure, the word structure, the vocabulary, the etymological derivation. How the word derives from one. There is so clearly a commonality between Sanskrit, Greek, Latin and Persian and Gothic, which is the ancestral language of modern German, that these must have had some common ancestral language at some point, which may no longer exist, which is also something that he proposed in an address to the Asiatic Society. That Asiatic Society address probably had fewer people than are in this audience today. About 25 people or so were there. And then he publishes that. And this linguistic discovery really, that these languages had a commonality, that they had some parental language, actually was a mind-blowing revolution to scholars at that time. Then he undertakes a translation of the Abhijnana Shakuntalam. The Shakuntalam becomes a rage in England and in Paris and in Germany and in Vienna and all these places. They actually have operas of the Shakuntalam that they perform in English and French and Italian at that time, the translations, all these things happens. So basically, the received wisdom at that time was that Sanskrit is the mother of all Indian languages. Jones has proposed that these languages have some commonality, some parental. So effectively, he seeded the explosion of linguistics as a study, the worldwide linguistics as a study. Remember, the British were also discovering Egyptian hieroglyphics. They were understanding Sumerian cuneiform. They were deciphering this at the same time, at this time. They were figuring out how to discover, British and French explorers. Thanks to colonialism, all the scholars were doing this. In the college of, in Fort William, Jones decided that any incoming British employee of the officer rank or of a writer, anybody who is going to do clerical or bureaucratic work, required a working language understanding of Sanskrit and Persian. Because even though Arabic was the language of the Muslims, a lot of the transactions were happening in Persian. Governmental work was happening in Persian. That they needed to understand Sanskrit and Persian. Besides any Hindi they could pick up. Hindi they could pick up by chattering on the streets. But Sanskrit and Persian they could not. They had to study. So he establishes the court, which actually Warren Hastings encouraged him. Warren Hastings established the college of Fort St. William. And Jones designed the curriculum. And from then on, any employee of the East India Company who came for bureaucratic work or legal work would study for a couple of years at this college of Fort St. William. Notice that they would do this even for Madras. A person coming to the Madras presidency to govern would go to Fort St. William, learn Sanskrit or Persian in this language and come to Madras. This is where Ellis comes in. That is 1784. That college is established. You have 15 years that's going on. Ellis comes to Madras as a writer, not as an extraordinarily reputed scholar like William Jones, but very humbly as a writer, just like Clive came before him. Except he's not famous for Concus, he's actually not very famous at all. Hopefully slightly more famous after this lecture. He comes to East India Company as a very humble writer, the lowest rank that you can enter the bureaucratic ranks. Ellis, unlike William Jones, was only familiar with some degree of English, probably some knowledge of French and Latin, we don't know. But probably, definitely no Sanskrit, no Persian, he didn't know all that. But when he comes to India, because he goes through the training, he learns Sanskrit and Persian. Now, it turns out that Ellis is a god also, just like William Jones, has a remarkable affinity for languages, learns languages very quickly. In 1798, he becomes the assistant undersecretary. In 1801, he becomes a deputy secretary. In 1802, he becomes a revenue secretary. And I think as revenue secretary, he is also in charge of minting coins. Mint supervisor in the Madras presidency. And this will have relevance a little later, which will come to it. In 1806, he was posted in Tanjavur. Remember, Tanjavur is the major kingdom in the Madras presidency. By then, the king has, I think, turned over the kingdom to the East India Company. Pudukkote is really the only last independent kingdom. But the king is receiving a pension. He still has a court. And the courts are happening in Mysore and all these other places. Some fellow did something that Ellis wanted to arrest that person. But he is a close relative of the king of Tanjavur. So that protection was happening. Ellis was unhappy. Ellis wanted to take action. The East India Company said, no, let's not take, there are legal niceties and social niceties, so we'll let him go. So they did the one thing that we see even today happening. They transferred him. They transferred Ellis. They transferred Ellis to Machilipatnam, where he served as a judge for a brief time. In Machilipatnam, he learned Telugu. In Tamil, in Madras, in Tanjavur, he's already learned a lot of Tamil. And he feels that learning Tamil is not easy if you come from a background of Sanskrit or Persian. Second, he says the Sanskrit and Persian is not very useful at all in the Madras presidency. He goes to Machilipatnam. He very quickly learns Telugu. Remember, he has a remarkable affinity for languages. He very quickly learns this language. And he encounters another person, an Indian scholar, Brahmin Pandit, called Bomakunti Sankara Sastri. And Sankara Sastri plays a very important role in Ellis' life. And we'll tell about him a little later. Shankara Sastri and Ellis discover a commonality between Telugu and Tamil that they see is not very common, that there are differences between Sanskrit and these languages. So, it's a learning that spark, that transfer because of social niceties resulted in Ellis learning a language and seeded his project of discovering some commonality between these languages. So, he decides, he petitions the government of the East India Company at that time and says, look, if you are sending people to the Bombay Presidency or to the Bengal Presidency, you can, Bombay Presidency is not fully occupied area. The Marathas are still in power. There is a Bombay Presidency, but the English don't control a lot of the Maharashtra state. The Marathas are still in power, the Sikhs are still in power. It is only after Ellis's time that the Maratha and the Sikh kingdoms are defeated and those domains also come under East India Company domain. So you must remember that. Bengal and Madras still are the major presidencies and major administrative centers for the East India Company, though Bombay is making a lot of money for them. So he tells them that we need to train people in Madras with Tamil, Telugu, Kannada, etc. because those are the languages that are used here. Don't send them to Calcutta, send them to Madras. We will start a college here. And in 1810, he comes back as collector of Madras. In 1812, he starts the Madras Literary Society. Actually, there is a library there. I think the Madras Literary Society may have already been started, but he is a major force. Even if somebody else started it, he is a driving force in this organization. The Madras Literary Society still survives in this building. This building is there on College Road. It's part of the DPI campus, the Directorate of Public Instruction campus. So, there's a small building. They are restored recently. This now functions as a very nice library of a lot of those books that they collected, printed, etc. And you can still become a member and enjoy the the books, the book collections that they have. So, the East India Company listens to him. Remember, unlike Jones, he is not a very powerful person. He is only risen up the ranks from the lower rank to collector. Jones was a puny judge of the Supreme Court, very respected person. And he had the confidence of Warren Hastings, who was the Governor General at that time. And he had a great reputation as a scholar even before he got on the boat in London. So he had a reputation as an international scholar. Ellis has nothing of this. He very quickly rises up from the ranks and he recommends to the East India Company that they start a college in Madras. Now the College of Fort St. George is started, but the college actually serves not in Fort St. George but in this DPI campus. You see that building there, you see that arch there, that arch is actually an entrance to the boat, to the Kuom River. The not many bridges have been built at that time. So what happens is that the students study here in this college, that campus, that building there in that along the Kuom River is the actual College of Fort St. George, and that is the college after which College Road is named, not Women's Christian College, which came 100 years later. So, Mr. Muthaya, who is one of the famous chroniclers of Madras history, says that the governor of who actually lived in Fort St. George at that time, would come every year and hold the convocation of the graduates of the College of Fort St. George. He would take a boat from Fort St. George, come by the Kuom, land here. That is why there is a big arch on the river facing front. Today the river is obsolete. It is a sewage. We don't use the river as a transportation means. But in those times, railways is not there, horse carriages only are there and they are not very convenient. You can't cross the river easily. So that governor comes by boat to this particular place and he comes here. And the College of Fort St. George is really started by Ellis, and that's training these East India Company employees in Tamil, Telugu and all that, besides their bureaucratic work. So he chairs an examination committee for the junior civil servants. They studied 5 languages. They appointed local teachers to teach these languages. Note clearly that there are Tamil is separated into 2 categories, High Tamil and Low Tamil, Sindhamil and Kodum Tamil. Then Malayalam, Telugu and Kannada are also taught to the civil servants at the asset this. And look at this principle that Ellis is using. Teach Tamil as a representative for all five. Now, that's a very remarkable statement. This is before he has proposed or discovered the commonality of these languages. And remember, the prevailing belief, while Jones has discovered that this Sanskrit and Greek and Latin have a common ancestor language which may be lost, the belief in India is still that all Indian languages are descendants of Sanskrit. They are all, Sanskrit is the mother of all Indian languages. But he says, teach Tamil as a representative for all five. To assist this, he sets up a printing press. This is one of the remarkable puzzles about Indian history, that until this time, until the early 19th century, Indians for some reason did not take to printing. Until Ellis's printing of all these works on a printing press, most of Tamil and Indian manuscripts were actually only on palm leaves. Scholarship was considered something that people who read palm leaves do, even though printing had been introduced to India 200 years earlier by the various Danish East India Company. When the Germans came, they wished Thomas Ziegenblatt established a mission in Trankabar. The Portuguese did it in Goa in the 16th century. But 200 years, printing is not absorbed as a technology. It took 200 years for them to establish. It's kind of like the telephones, I guess. Telephone was invented by Graham Bell in 1880s. It became worldwide very quickly, but for India, really it took until the 1980s to spread. So like that, this took a while. He published the Kodum Tamil of Veeramamunivar. Veeramamunivar was an Italian Jesuit priest who had come to India 150 years before Ellis, written a grammar for Tamil called the Kodum Tamil. He had also written a work called Thembavani, which is the story of the Bible and of Jesus, and he written it in very chaste Tamil. And Ellis started translating the Thirukkural. And it is Ellis's translation of Thirukkural that later is expanded upon by G.U. Pope. And he is the one who comes, publishes the full manuscript in English. So, these are the teachers that Ellis establishes at College of Fort St. George. Vedam Pattabhirama Shastri, Chidambara Vadiyar, Muthusami Pillai, Udayagiri Venkat Narayana and Syed Abdul Qadir. For Arabic and Persian, I am presuming. And these are people, two of them are teaching Tamil, Chidambara Vadiyar, Muthusami Pillai, Pattabhirama Shastri and Udayagiri Venkat Narayana, I think, are teaching Sanskrit and Telugu respectively. And I think they may have, Telugu scholars usually also tended to be Kannada scholars and probably is teaching both languages. Ellis established a circle here. I told you about the Madras Literary Society. Madras Literary Society effectively became a separate Asiatic society. There was a Royal Asiatic Society of Bengal. Asiatic Society of Bengal, I told you, they had a branch here also. But Ellis was the one who drove it and said, you are concentrating too much on Sanskrit because you are living in North India. You are concentrating too much on literature like Bengali literature and Prakrit literature, Buddhist literature. Those projects are going on. Here is a language and here is a set of languages that have a whole set of other histories, other literatures. They have very rich literatures, they have very rich traditions. There are a lot of things here that you are not looking at. And so he established a circle. Ellis was called Ellis Durai. He only lived 41 years. He was joined by William Erskine, who is one of the, who later on went to become governor of Bombay Presidency, John Leyden, and Arthur Duncan Campbell. And Campbell was working, and Ellis commissioned Campbell to provide a grammar book for the Telugu language. So Campbell is writing a book on the a grammar book for the Telugu language, just like Kodum Tamil is like a grammar for the Tamil language, and in Sanskrit there are already works on translating the Ashtadhyayi of Panini besides the Manusmriti. He is working, asking Campbell to work on it, and he is collaborated, like I said, about in Machilipatnam. He had gained the acquaintance of Bommakutti Shankara Shastri, who is referred to as Shankaraya. Shankaraya is a scholar in Sanskrit, in Telugu and Tamil. And he says to Ellis, Shankaraya could not have pulled this off by himself. He says to Ellis, Tamil and Telugu have a greater affinity towards each other, linguistic affinity, than Sanskrit. Because this linguistic thing, a mother of all languages thing, is still something that's going on. Ellis recognized that Tamil had a rich ancient literature rivaling Sanskrit, the only such Indian language. Actually, Prakrit also had a very little literature early on, but Prakrit lost continuity. That is, the number of new texts written in Prakrit probably was somewhere abandoned around the 10th, 11th centuries, when all the regional languages like Telugu and Marathi and other languages started developing their own literature. Those languages have existed for instance, time immemorial, but they did not have a separate rich literature. And if you look at all these languages, usually the first work in them, literary work with them, will be a Ramayana or a Mahabharata or some Bhagavatam or something that is already there in Sanskrit. You will see a translation of this. But Tamil has a literature, the Sangam literature, that is, and Alvar Pasurams and the Tevara songs and the Padanin Kirkanaku like Tirukural and Naladiyar and the Jain works like Sivaga Sintamani and other works like Silapadikaram. These are not having any connection to the Sanskrit literature extent at that time. They are original works in Tamil. They are not translations. So, he says, Tamil has a rich ancient literature rivaling Sanskrit, the only such Indian language. Now, you are seeing what's called a sectarian split between the researchers of the Bengal Asiatic School and the Madras Asiatic Society. This is called the Madras School of Orientalism by Professor Thomas Troutman, who rediscovered Ellis and has written a book about him, and I will show you that in a couple of minutes. So, Sankaraya theorizes that Telugu is actually a language that has a Tamil origin, but its grammar is written in Sanskrit style. So, they follow all the rules that Sanskrit would, that the Sanskrit grammarians have used, and Prakrit grammarians have then applied to write grammars of the various Prakrit languages like Pali and Ardhamagadhi and Shauraseni and Maharashtri and all those other languages. Grammars of all Prakrit languages, including Telugu, followed the Aindra outline. Now, I have to explain the Aindra. Aindra is the name of a grammar book written by a person called Indra, not the god Indra, but a person, a scholar called Indra. And his book is called the Aindram. In Sanskrit, it's called Aindra. In Tamil, it's called Aindram. Aindra was one of 11 or 12 grammarians who preceded Panini, who is the most famous grammarian of Sanskrit language. Panini's grammar, everybody knows. But Panini's grammar is not something that even the ordinary Sanskrit scholar can easily approach. You need somebody, it is very cryptic, it is very brief, it is very tightly done. You see this very famous phrase that Sanskrit is the best language for computers. You see this phrase appeared. That is because of Panini's Ashtadhyayi. Panini's Ashtadhyayi is written in a very breathtaking structure, and that structure is a structure that computer languages use to devise their grammars. The computer languages are written in a structure resembling Paninian grammar. They are very tight statements, they are very self-referential, cross-referential, there are special terms like deterministic automata, finance, those will go into computer jargon, and I don't want to go there. In fact, the bizarre thing is that Panini wrote a grammar for this. It was not necessarily at all for it to be that cryptic. You could only understand something by applying all kinds of complex rules that would refer to each other, and you had to know all of that grammar to understand it. You had to memorize the entire Ashtadhyayi to properly apply all the rules, and you had to be trained under a master to tell you which applies when. And that is the kind of structure that computer languages also use. No computer language is based on any natural language. Computer languages are all trying to put mathematical expressions with some English or Tamil or whatever word is, nothing to do with Sanskrit or anything. But Paninian, that grammar, is recognized by linguists as having a structure similar to the structure of computer languages grammar. That's why people guess it. But before Panini, there were 11 other scholars. I won't name all of them, I don't remember. Like Gautama, Galava, and Indra, most famous of them all. Indra is especially important because the famous Tamil grammar book, Tolhapiyam. Tolhapiyam is referred to as one phrase, Aindiram Niraindha. Aindiram Niraindha here means it is derived or structured like the Aindiram. Tolhapiyam is not cryptic like or it doesn't have that tight grammatical encoding structure like the Panini's Ashtadhyayi, and none of the other grammars that preceded Panini also had that tight structure. Tolhapiyam follows the Aindra principle. This, now, a lot of Tamil scholars will dispute this altogether, even though it's there in that document itself. Tolhapiyam follows the Aindra outline. That is something that he mentions. All these grammars become obsolete because when Panini made his book, the dominant one, the other grammars were abandoned by most scholars and they followed it. This is like one dictionary becoming obsolete because a later dictionary becomes popular. This is like modern astronomy text becoming, making something like Aryabhatta's astronomy or Archimedes or Ptolemy's astronomy obsolete. It's not a conspiracy or anything. It's just more recent technology will make some older book obsolete. Technically, when you have science or technology or grammar, it's something like that happens. A later edition will make an older edition obsolete. It will only be a scholarly pursuit for some people. Except Tamil. What am I saying here? The grammars of all Prakrit languages, including Telugu, followed the Aindra outline except Tamil. And where is he referring to this? Because I just told you, Tolhapiyam is following the Aindra outline. But it is following the Aindra outline in laying it. What is the Aindra outline? The Aindra outline says, first deal with little letters, then deal with words, then deal with grammatical rules. That is the structure. But the grammar of the language is very different. The grammar of Tamil is not the same as the grammar of Sanskrit. Sanskrit has a lot of prefixes. Tamil has almost no prefixes. So, in Sanskrit, I'll give you a quick example. You have a word like chara. Chara means walk. From chara, you derive charanam. Charanam are your feet. That is a suffix. Charati means he walks. Charami, charami means I walk. So, you have a suffix that says, in Tamil also you have a similar structure. Parthen, parthan, parthadu. So, the suffix will tell you who is doing it, action. But Sanskrit has a bunch of prefixes. Achara means non-walking. The A prefix indicates an opposite. The A prefix, achara, what does it mean? Today we understand acharam as discipline or character. Nalla nadathai, that's what acharam is. And the person who teaches you achara is the acharya, your guru. Your teacher teaches you. So, you see how brilliantly the word encodes these things. You don't have such prefixes. So, samchara. So, you have word like, sam is another word. Pari, pra. So, you have a word like prakaram, prakaram, akaram. You have words where the kara will be the basic word. Kara will be a derived word. And you have a bunch of prefix words like stana. For example, samstanam. You'll have a word like samstanam. You'll have a word like sangramam. Gramam will be there. Sangrama, sangraha. So, you have prefixes like that. So, you are not seeing this in Tamil. You are seeing none of this prefixes you don't see in Tamil. Second, Sanskrit is written in a particular form of meter called chandas. So, if you have like Shuklam, Bharadaram, Vishnum, Shashivarnam, Chaturbhujam, that is in a meter called Anushtubh meter. So, you will see, not Shuklam, Bharadaram, but Vishwam, Vishnum, Vashakaro, I think is in Anushtubh. Shuklam, Bharadaram also is in Anushtubh. But some other things will have some other meter. So, Vishwam Vishnur Vashatkaro Bhuta Bhavya Bhavat Prabhu. You can see that. It eight syllables, it forms. You'll have another this thing like, say, Samtaptaya Sisansitasya Payaso Nama Pinashru Yate. One line. You have 23 syllables. Muktakara Tayatadeva Nalini Patrasthitam. So, you see 23 syllable meters. That will be called something. This one is actually called Shardula Vikrititam. You have different meters. Tamil has nothing like this. What do we have? We have Tamil meters like Kural, Kuralpa, Venba, Kalippa, Vanjippa, and Asiriyappa, which letter by letter, word by word, split by split, looks nothing at all like the Sanskrit or any of the derived forms. And Tamil also has alliterative forms like Yadugai and Monai. The first letter will always rhyme or the second letter will always rhyme. So you see that structure. So he says, this is a very different structure. So, it is not based on the Sanskrit grammar. And Tamil has, once we get to this Pavagai is categorized under something called Yapu in Tamil. The Yapu is completely different from Chandas. The syllable meters, the counting, the rhythming, none of that has anything to do with Sanskrit. The counting structure itself is different. But we have borrowed from there and so on. In Telugu, in the Telugu dictionaries that he is dealing with, Sankara Sastri says there are words that are categorized according to their nature. You see this in later Tamil grammars also, like Virachodyam, I think you'll see this. Even in Tolhapiyam, I think there are some references to it. You have words that are what's called Tat Sama, that are equivalent or same as Sanskrit. So you have Rama, Rama is the Sanskrit word, Krishna is the Sanskrit word. In Hindi, it will become Ram and Krishna and Indra. They'll cut off that last Visarga part. In Telugu, it will become Ramudu, Ramulu. In Kannada, it will become Ramayya. In Tamil, it will become Raman or Ramar. You see the suffixes are varying. That's the Tatsama word. It's a word that is exactly the same. Then you have words that are Tadbhava. The word will be very similar, or it is a word that will give the same bhava. It will have a meaning that is similar, but very maybe different. Basically kind of a synonym. The word will not be the same, but it will mean the same. Then you have Deshya. These are country words. These are words that are not found in Sanskrit, but will be found in all some of the Prakrits. That will be some regional reference to something or the other that will not be there. For example, Puli. Puli is a Tamil word that says it's a tiger. In Sanskrit word will be Vyagra. This word will not be there. Or there will be some Kocha words or something. Yachal. You will not necessarily find the equivalent in Sanskrit. So there are words, there will be words like that. Then there are Gramya words. So Gramya are village words that you will not find even in a lot of grammar books. So these are words that are tend to be used by the vulgar sections of society, or even by sophisticated sections when they want to be vulgar. So these are the words that are used like that. Then you have Antardeshya words, which actually you have in Sanskrit also. Sanskrit occasionally has borrowed from Persian or other languages, Latin and all that. Some words are there. You have exotic words, and the exotic words, actually Mlecha and Antardeshya, I don't know what that means. I think Mlecha is less sophisticated and Antardeshya is more sophisticated or something like that. Foreign words that you have. There is actually others, a category called Paribhasha, but you won't go into the technical words. He says this category is not there in the early Tamil grammar. Actually, it's there in the later Tamil grammar. You have, actually, in later Tamil grammar, you see the tremendous influence of Sanskrit literature, and you will see things that are there like Bahuvrihi, which is nothing, there is no such thing in Tamil at all, but you will see these terms explained simply because they are in Sanskrit. You'll put them just because they are in Sanskrit. So you'll see words like that. So he formed a word table. And you look at the word table actually, what the system is you put a word, you put a Tamil word, a Telugu word, a Kannada word, a Malayala word, and you look at all of them. And they seem to have a common root. They all seem to sound similar roots, but their suffixes may be different because the words will sound distinct. They are similar sounding words. So the corruption may not be in the last letter, but it may be in the first letter. So Tamil, a lot of pa in Tamil will sound like ha in Kannada. Palli will be halli, palu will be halu, and so on. But so you see that kind of thing. You see a lot of those words. I can show you the book. I'll come to this. There's a 40-page document that he writes, that Ellis writes. So you'll have different word roots in Sanskrit and Telugu. He says kak, for example, in Sanskrit is the root word for laughing. In Telugu, it's vomit. In Tamil, it's kakkarad. It's a vomit, the word root for vomit. So he sees all these differences and says, okay, between Shankaraya and Ellis, they decide that this is a different group of languages, and that's where he exposes that. And should he publish? Ellis had a principle. So this is the other statement that he makes. He actually submits papers to the Asiatic Society. He talks about these. Tamil, Telugu are not Sanskrit derivations. Sanskrit may contribute to their polish, but not necessary for their existence. It's a very important point that he makes. They form a distinct family of languages, which is Sanskrit as intermixed, but has no radical connection. In Telugu and Malayalam, it is so intermixed that you can't even distinguish it. A lot of the words, Sanskrit words, Telugu words have probably dropped off from Malayalam and Telugu. That only the Sanskrit words remain. The original Tamil words or the root Telugu words no longer remain. You will see it. Also, you will see that Sanskrit words derived from a language mean different things in these different languages. Vyavasaya, for example. Vyavasayam in Tamil means agriculture. But Vyavasaya in Sanskrit actually means enterprise, effort, work. In Malayalam, it actually means industry. Vyavasaya is somebody, he's a Vyavasayi means he's an entrepreneur or a businessman. So you'll see words like that. So, but no radical connection. Radical here comes from the word radix, which means root. So the root connection is not there. So based on this, this is actually a much more recent map. They discovered that there's a whole bunch of Dravidian languages. Some of this work comes much later. You see people in the next 40 years, including Caldwell, come up with all these languages. And they discovered it's not just Telugu, Tamil, Kannada, but there are about 24 different languages that belong to the Dravidian group. The Indian continent actually doesn't have two language groups as we think, but actually five language groups. The Aryan or the Sanskritic based language group, which is part of the Indo-European group of languages, which is marked in the dull green kind of thing. The Dravidian, which is kind of in this dull violet kind of script. Remember, note that Sinhala is also grouped with the Aryan group of languages. Then we have this little red purple patches in between. Those are the Munda languages, which are also called Austro-Asiatic languages. It's a very small subgroup. In the Andaman Islands, which is not clearly visible, they are completely a different group of languages called the Malayo-Polynesian languages. You'll not deal with them. And you can see in the northern border, they are actually forming form of the Tibeto-Burman languages, because those are the languages spoken by those people, which are actually have more connection to the Chinese group of languages. They are actually called of a larger family called the Sino-Tibetan language family. So, Jones' discovery of Sanskrit was the Sanskrit and Proto-Indo-European was the first discovery, and Ellis's discovery of the Dravidian group languages was the second discovery. Okay, so Ellis, one note about Ellis, he died when he was 41 of stomach poisoning. He was in Ramanathapuram doing something. He had some stomach problem regularly. Some native person gave him some medicine. It turned out that that medicine was not curing him, but actually made it worse, and he died of stomach poisoning shortly afterwards. He actually wrote a treatise, wrote a will, bequeathing some of his things to his mother, to his friends, his collection to Duncan Campbell and to Erskine, and something for his cook and servant. He writes all that. While he knows he's dying, he's doing all that. He writes a will, and he unfortunately dies at the age of 41. It's much more unfortunate that he died at 41, because he had made a commitment to himself that he would not put down any of his literary researches. Remember, this is all not his primary work. His primary work is working as the East India Company collector and government servant. All this is doing on a side time, as a hobby, while he's also developing these things. So, he determined that he would not write anything independently until he was 40. And within a year he died. He didn't expect to die at 41. Jones died at 48. Ellis died at 41. Prinsep died at 39. We have some great scholars who came to India and died at very young ages, very tragically. So we had a great loss to him. But the book I told you about, the Alexander Duncan Campbell's Telugu grammar book, the one that he commissioned, to that book, he wrote a 40-page introduction. The dictionary is big, but the introduction is 40 pages. In that introduction, he writes a note on the Dravidian languages, and that is the first thing that we have, first documentary evidence that we have, that Ellis was the person who discovered that this Dravidian group of languages is there, besides a couple of his papers to the Asiatic Society. And 40 years later, when Caldwell comes along and he uses the same terminology, Dravidian group of languages, but he is not mentioned Ellis, he's not given credit to Ellis, even though he probably read this book. We don't give, historians don't give proper credit to Caldwell for discovering the Munda group of languages, which is the third group. At the same time, one of Ellis's friend, which I mentioned about him earlier, William Erskine, actually a guy called William Marsden, he's not there. William Marsden discovered the Malayo-Polynesian group of languages. He goes to Malaysia and discovers that those languages have an affinity to each other. So these people are all working to discover whole groups of languages, and he's also a colleague of his. He discovers that. Then, as in 1796, Edward Jenner had discovered vaccination. That he discovered that if you extract the little pustules from a cow's udder, that infection of cowpox, and you introduce it into little children, that children will have a short period of that fever, but they will never develop that any of those measles afterwards. So he discovers that. Ellis in 1812 wanted to introduce vaccination in the Madras Presidency to inoculate children. He could not get people to accept injecting themselves at that time. People would simply not this thing. So he perpetrates a fraud. He writes a book called the Aram Avara Vilakkam. Aram, sixth, A, Kau, Vara, Boon, Vilakkam. Explanation. The Tamils or the Indians since time immemorial have this respect for the five products of the cow, the Panchagavyam. The milk, curd, butter, urine and dung. The Panchagavyam are the five great products. So he says, this vaccine, this thing that he extracts from the cow's pustules, is the sixth Gavyam. This is not going to be accepted by anybody. So he perpetrates a fraud. He invents a dialogue between Dhanvantri and Shakti. He invents a king who lost his sons to cowpox, and the king, you know, laments, and then Narada appears to the king and says, "Oh king, your son died because of the cowpox, there is no cure for it. But Shakti, in her great compassion, has discovered, decided to give you a sixth Gavyam from the cow. If you take this sixth Gavyam and inject it, at least your future subjects will not suffer from it." And he creates this Sanskrit text called Shakteya Grantham. He writes this. Ellis writes this. Then he translates this Shakteya Grantham and a narrative of this into a conversation between Dhanvantri and Shakti. And then he presents this to the Tamil public and says this is the sixth Gavyam. So you can see what's going on. He is trying to, you know, induct a scientific policy to vaccinate people. People simply would not accept it. We may remember about 15-20 years back, people were refusing to take polio drops. Even today in places, they are refusing to take polio drops. You had to do advertisements by Rajinikanth and Manorama before that would really became very popular in Tamil Nadu. You remember that the television advertisements where Rajinikanth would say, "Give polio drops to your daughter." Even MGR could not pull it off. It had Rajinikanth come and do television ads to pull it off. And then once they do, some star people, you know, you'll start. So he is trying to do this using the religious. So he's pulling off a fraud. But this is called a pious fraud by another researcher who comes along 70 years later. And so, actually, it's very interesting because Troutman, who researched this book, only could found the English translation of this work. And so he has appended his English translation of this Shakteya Grantham and Aram Avara Vilakkam. But last 2 months back, a Tamil scholar called Manu Francis discovered the Tamil root, the Tamil original in a library in France, which belonged to an Englishman's collection. And I had contacted Thomas Troutman by email and he had notified it to me. And here is Ellis' little propaganda work in Tamil. I won't read all of it, but I'll read. Ellisan Nallarulai, and I can't read the other word clearly, Utpurulai Iyambiyadal, Ellisan Ippadinai Payilvor Sugam Inbameyyam. He's trying to pass this off in the way the Pasurams were written, you know, say, in the Pathu Padithavargalakalam Naraya Punyam Kadekum. He's trying to do this in this thing. So this was recently discovered and it was very kindly. So Mr. I must give credit to Troutman and Manu Francis, and I actually borrowed the thing from him, the copy of the, downloaded this thing from him. So there are other things that Ellis did. Most importantly, he wrote a treatise on Mirasi rites. Ellis had been reading a lot of inscriptions from our temples. He collected them, compiled them. He was doing this as part of the work for the Asiatic Society and for the Madras Literary Society. But once he reads that, he realizes that the property rights and inheritance rights, grants to people, land administration in Tamil Nadu under the Cholas and the Pandyas and the Pallavas before them, he didn't know about the Pallavas, but the Cholas and the Pandyas, he reads all these things. He says it's very different from the prevalent system which was predominantly introduced by Muslim rights. In Muslim law, a king will grant something to a person. That person can enjoy that until his lifetime and his family can enjoy it. But when he stops, that person dies, his family can no longer enjoy it. So suppose a grand land is granted, rent from that land is granted, it will only be for that particular poet or scholar or somebody. And when he passes away, that will be taken away unless the king or the local ruler decides to grant it again. In India now, it's not like that. You see inscription after inscription, copper plate after copper plate, you will see, "I grant this to this scholar and his descendants so that it will last as long as the sun and the moon exist." They won't last that long. They'll fight among themselves after 3 generations, split the property. Some other king will come along and everything will be starting again. But they'll grant it in perpetuity. He says, Indians have a whole different set of rights. And here you are, all these India British scholars are using this zamindari system to perpetuate land rights. No. And they are talking of oriental despots. They are saying all Indian kings, all Orient, From Arabia to China, they were all despots. There are no benevolent kings, there are no rules. Whatever the king said, this is the mindset of the some of the British and European scholars at that time. Because remember, they were also doing white man's burden at this time. They were rescuing us from the savagery of our kings. They were rescuing us from the, you know, tyranny of our traditions. They were rescuing us from the tyranny of the Brahmins or the Mullahs or whomever you want to call them. They were doing all this. So, while this scholarship effort is going on, a separate school of Anglo supremacy is also coming along. Or European supremacy and white supremacy is also coming along. Typified superbly by Rudyard Kipling, but who came up with the phrase white man's burden, but they are also doing this. So he talked about this. In Madras at that time is the famous Thomas Munro, for whom we have a statue on the island grounds. And Thomas Munro became governor of Madras. But long after Ellis has passed away, Ellis passed away in 1819, Munro is still the and he is the one who is trying to bring in the Rayatwari scheme in South India, administer the Rayatwari scheme. But Munro is writing article after article in newspapers, in government documents, saying, you know what Ellis said? I dispute it because Ellis is dead. He is a collector. He is a minor ranking official compared to a governor of the presidency. He is dead and he is gone. Nobody is reading it. Here is Munro, governor, you know, monarch of all his surveys, disputing Ellis 15 years after that person is died. Because that is the impact that the scholarship had on the other people, are saying, no, see, you should administer this. But eventually, Munro was the one who prevailed. The Rayatwari scheme was what prevailed, and the Zamindari system continued in India until independence and so on. The other thing that Ellis did was expose something called Yedur Vedam. Yedur Vedam was a real fraud, not a pious fraud like this Shakteya Grantham, but a real fraud by a person called Roberto Di Nobili, who was Padriyar, was an Italian priest who came to India, Jesuit priest, I think, he came to India. He was a good friend of Thirumalai Nayak. There are rumors that he tried to convert Thirumalai Nayak into a Christian. He wrote a thing called the Yedur Vedam, which is a Sanskrit work, which claims that the Bible is another Veda. That is what is, that is the Sanskrit, oh, it's all this thing, the Bible was the other Veda, it's all Christian, you should convert, you should worship this thing also. You can see a lot of people in the, even today, you know, dealing with this kind of thing going on. You are claiming that Tirukkural is a Christian and, you know, Kanyakumari is Mother Mary and all that other stuff still going on. So, Ellis clearly wrote this, studied this and said, no, this is a complete fraud. He exposed it. So, he is also famous for that. He also was working on some things like Manipravala poetry. This is actually a poetry poem that is written by Ellis. He published collections of these things. Remember, he introduced print and type to the Madras presidency. He had to literally set Telugu and Tamil type. So the Madras East India Company or the College of Fort St. George would come out with publications. So this is a very interesting stuff. The half of it is in Tamil, the other half is in Sanskrit. Arumbai pola tavadanta panktihi. Tavadanta panktihi means your teeth, the row of your teeth. Kurumbai pola, like coconuts. Kuchamandala dvayam. I leave that to your imagination. Karumbai pola madura chavani. Karumbai pola, it's sweet as madura chavani. Sweet is your words or your words. He's talking about a woman. Your like arumbu poo pola, your shining white, like your teeth are shining white like the arumbu poo. Your kuchamandala dvayam are like this thing. And karumbai pola, your words. And irumbai pola, hridayam kim masit. Why is your heart alone like iron? So this is a kind of, this is a casual poem that he has written. He has actually written a poem on Ramachandra Kavirayar, who is one of this thing. And I'll come to his major poem. And while he was translating, I told you he was also a mint supervisor. While he was translating the Tirukkural, he also became enamored of Thiruvalluvar and decided to issue a coin of the East India Company with Thiruvalluvar on one side of the coin. This coin was actually lost for a long time. And the coin was recently rediscovered about 15 years back, I think. Two coins were discovered in Calcutta Museum by Airavatham Mahadevan, who is a somewhat famous archaeologist for most of you. Also, another amateur who, you know, went into the administrative services and decided to do a lot of archaeological work. And very famously, during a drought in Madras in 1818, I think, he commissioned the digging of 27 wells. And on those 27 wells, he had an inscription written in Tamil. This inscription, this plate, that is the plate that Mr. Narasaya is a historian. He wrote a book called Madrasapatnam and he wrote another book called Alavayanagiri about Madurai. And while he was researching Madurai, he discovered this plaque in this Ellis inscription in the Thirumalai Nayak Mahal, which is where this is. This photo is from Thirumalai Nayak Mahal. And it was lying discarded, and he asked them to put it on a plaque, at least give it some significance, put it up on a plaque. There are 27 of these inscriptions, we believe, in Madras. This was discovered several years back in a well in Rayapeta, and it was transferred to this particular place. And Mr. Narasaya included this inscription in his book on Tamil called Madrasapatnam. I recently went in March to Madurai and I took a photo of Narasaya. So I will translate this poem and I will conclude my talk within about 5 minutes. So translating from Ellis's verse to Tamil that we can understand. Sayankonda thonniya saanuru naadenum. I am only showing you one small portion of the inscription that's there. ஆழியில் இடைத்த அழகுரு மாமணி குணக்கடன் முதலாக குடக்கடல் அளவு ஜெயங்கொண்ட தொண்டிய சானுரு நாடு. ஜெயங்கொண்ட மண்டலம் இஸ் த நேம் ஃபார் தொண்டை மண்டலம் தட் வாஸ் கிவன் பை தி சோழாஸ். வென் தே கான்கர்ட் த பல்லவா கண்ட்ரி தே கால்ட் இட் ஜெயங்கொண்ட சோழ மண்டலம். ஜெயங்கொண்ட தொண்டிய சானுரு நாடுனும் ஆழியில் இழைத்த அழகுரு மாமணி. ஆழி இஸ் கடல், த சி. இழைத்த அழகுரு மாமணி, இந்த இந்தியன் ட்ரெடிஷன் வி பிலீவ் தட் ஆல் த ஜெம்ஸ்டோன்ஸ் கம் ஃப்ரம் த சி. So the gemstone, the sea of the eastern sea created the gemstone. What gemstone is this? Kudakadan mudalaha kudakadal lalav. From western mountain to eastern sea, nedinilam thaada nimirundidu chenna pattanathu ellisan. Nedinilam thaada nimirundidu chenna pattanam. What is the gem? Chenna pattanam. So he is saying Chennai is the gem brought up by the Sea of the Bay of Bengal. அந்த சென்னப்பட்டணத்து எல்லீசன் என்பவன் நானே யானே. ஐ ஆம் சென்னப்பட்டணத்து எல்லீசன், நாட் இங்கிலீஷ்காரன் எல்லீசன். சென்னப்பட்டணத்து எல்லீசன் என்பவன் யானே பண்டாரக்காரியம் பார சுமக்கையில். பண்டாரக்காரியம் இஸ் மின்ட் சூப்பர்வைசர். த பண்டாரக்காரியம் இஸ் பண்டாரம் இஸ் த நேம் ஃபார் த கஜானா. பண்டாரக்காரிய பாரம் சுமக்கையில் புலவர்கள் பெருமான் மயிலையம் பதியான். மயிலாப்பூர் அம்பதி, த சிட்டி ஆஃப் மயிலாப்பூர் விச் இஸ் ஃபேமஸ் ஃபார் கிரேட் போயட்ஸ். தெய்வ புலமை திருவள்ளுவனார் திருக்குறள் தன்னில் திருவுளம் பற்றி. வாட் திருவள்ளுவர் ஃபேமஸ்லி ஆஃப் மயிலாப்பூர் ரோட் இன் திருக்குறள், இருப்புணலும் வாய்த்த மலையும் வறுப்புணலும் வல்லரனும் நாட்டிற்கு உறுப்பு. ஹி இஸ் கோட்டிங் அ திருக்குறள். வாட் இஸ் திஸ் திஸ் திருக்குறள் மீன்? இரு புனலும் ஸ்டேயிங் வாட்டர். புனல் மீன்ஸ் வாட்டர். இரு புனல் இஸ் ஸ்டாக்னன்ட் வாட்டர். ஸோ லேக்ஸ், பாண்ட்ஸ், வெல்ஸ், திங்ஸ் லைக் தட். வாய்த்த மலையும் நேச்சுரல் மவுண்டன்ஸ், வறு புனலும் ஃப்ளோயிங் வாட்டர், இன்கமிங் வாட்டர், ரெயின்ஸ் அண்ட் ரிவர்ஸ் அண்ட் ஸ்ட்ரீம்ஸ், தோஸ் ஆர் ஃப்ளோயிங் வாட்டர். வல் அரணும் ஸ்ட்ராங் வால், வல் அரண் நாட்டிற்கு உறுப்பு. தீஸ் ஆர் தி இம்பார்ட் எசென்சியல்ஸ் ஃபார் அ சிட்டி ஆர் ஆர் அ கண்ட்ரி. திஸ் இஸ் வாட் திருவள்ளுவர் இன் ஒன் ஆஃப் இஸ் குரல்ஸ் சேஸ். என்பதின் பொருளை என்னுள் ஆய்ந்து, ஐ ஹவ் அப்சார்ப் திஸ் மீனிங் டீப்லி இன்சைட் மீ. ஸ்வஸ்தி ஸ்ரீ ஸ்வாலிவாகன சகாப்த வருஷம், தேர் இஸ் அ தமிழ் நம்பர் தேர், செல்லா நின்ற இங்கிலீஷ் வருஷம். ஸோ ஹி கோஸ் தி எஃபர்ட் ஆஃப் யூசிங் போத் த ஸ்வாலிவாகன வருஷம் அண்ட் த இங்கிலீஷ் வருஷம். ஆண்டில் பிரபாவி வருஷத்துக்கு மேற் செல்லா நின்ற பகுதான்ய வருஷத்தில் வார திதி நட்சத்திர யோக கரணம் பார்த்து, பஞ்சாங்கத்தில் இருக்க வேண்டிய அஞ்சுதியும் பார்த்துட்டு நல்ல நாளை தேடி நட்சத்திர சுபதினத்திலே சுபதினத்தில் இதனோடு 27 துறவு கண்டு. துறவு இஸ் வெல். 27 வெல்லை நான் வந்து ஐ ஆஸ் தம் டு டிக் ஃபார் த பெனிஃபிட் ஆஃப் த பீப்புள் ஆஃப் புண்ணியாக வாசனம் பண்ணுவித்தேன். வெரி ஆழியில் இழைத்த அழகுரு மாமணின்னு மெட்ராஸ்க்கு யாவனும் டைட்டிலே கொடுத்தது கிடையாது. என்ன, நகரேஷு காஞ்சி இஸ் தி க்ளோசஸ்ட் காம்படிஷன் ஃபார் அ டைட்டில் ஆஃப் அ சிட்டி. பியூட்டிஃபுல், பியூட்டிஃபுல் ஃப்ரேஸ். ஸோ இட் பர்ஃபெக்ட்லி ஜஸ்டிஃபைட் இன் காலிங் செல்லப்பட்ட தெல்லீசன். அண்ட் ஐ திங்க் ஐ ஆல்சோ வித் திஸ் ஐ ஜஸ்டிஃபைட் தட் ஒய் ஐ சோசன் திஸ் எல்லிஸ் ரதர் தன் எல்லிஸ் ஆர் டங்கன். நாட் தட் ஐ நோ மச் அபவுட் எல்லிஸ் ஆர் டங்கன், ஐ மச் மோர் கம்ஃபர்டபுள் வித் திஸ் பர்சன். ஸோ And in great tribute, we'll go, this is Thomas Troutman, who actually rediscovered Ellis and wrote a book called Languages and Nations, and this is a Tamil translation of that work. And so on Ellis's epitaph, there is an epitaph, there are two epitaphs actually. One is in Ramanathapuram where he died, and another is tombstone is in Dindigul. I haven't seen it, but in the introduction to this book, it's there, this epitaph is there. Ellisan ennum yerpeyar odayon. Think about this, how the Tamils are honoring. His name is Ellis, not Ellison. But he's been converted. Ellison என்னும் இயற்பெயருடையோ natural name இருந்தவனை முத்தமிழ் ஆரியம் முதற் பல கசடர கற்றறிந்தவற்றுள் கலை பல உணர்ந்தோம். பியூட்டிஃபுல் ஃப்ரேஸ் டு டிஸ்கிரைப் ஹிம். முத்தமிழ் ஆரியம் இஸ் சான்ஸ்கிரிட், முதற் பல செவரல், கசடு அற லைக் அவர் கற்ற கற்க கசடர, கசடர கற்றறிந்து அவற்றுள் கலை பல உணர்ந்தோம். ஜெனுவின்லி அ கிரேட் ஸ்காலர். அண்ட் ஐ எம் ஸ்கிப்பிங் சம் ஃப்ரேசஸ். மனு முத நூல்களில் வழக்கு நெறி அனைத்தும் இனமுற தொகுத்து இங்கிலீஷில் விரித்தோம். As part of his work, he is doing this. Manusmriti mari irukkira pala noolla English la. Actually, what he did was not Manusmriti, because he was doing Thirukkural and some other text he has done, in the, including the grammar. Dot, dot, dot. I am skipping again. Thiruvalluvar peyar deivan cheppi arulkura noolul arappavil arappalinukku. So, Ellis's work was only up to the Arappal. He had not translated the Kamappal and the this thing, the Arappal. பொருட்பால் தங்க தங்கு பல நூல் உதாரண கடலை பெய்து, அதுல இருந்து பல நூல் உதாரண கடலை பெய்து. ஸோ அந்த மாதிரி எக்ஸாம்பிள்ஸ் எடுத்துட்டு கடல் கடலாக கொட்டினா இங்கிலீஷ் தனில் இணங்க மொழி பெயர்த்தோன். தெர் இஸ் மோர், ஐ ஆம் நாட் ரீடிங் பிகாஸ் ஐ டோன் வாண்ட் டு கோ ஆன் அண்ட் ஆன். ஸோ திஸ் இஸ் த எபிடாஃப் ஆன் இட். அண்ட் தெர் இஸ் திஸ் இஸ் ஐ எம் ஷோயிங் ஒன் தேர்ட் ஆஃப் தட் எபிடாஃப். ஐ திங்க் இட்ஸ் ஆக்சுவலி எ ஃபிட்டிங் எபிடாஃப். ஐ ஆம் நாட் ஷுர் ஹூ ரோட் திஸ் பர்டிகுலர் ஒன். தட் வாஸ் த எபிடாஃப் ஆஃப் எலிஸ் அட் த டைம். And we don't have a statue of Ellis. We don't have a street or a highway or anything named after Ellis. There is actually in Mount Road, there is a street named after Ellis and an Ellispuram. But I suspect that is actually named after a chief secretary who came in the 1850s. Because more important official, right? Chief secretary, S.R. Ellis, rather than F.W. Ellis. But Ellis is remembered among several others. Ayodhidasa Pandita, for example, recognizes him in his works. So at best I can say thanks to people like Troutman for discovering him and exposing it and writing a book about it. And with that, I'd like to conclude this talk. And thank you once again for the patience of listening to my lecture. If you have any questions,